Lecture 8, The Roman Conquest of Spain.
In this lecture, I plan to look at the Roman conquest of Spain, primarily from the year 197 BC down to 133 BC, that is, through much of the 2nd century BC. This is a period where the Romans were forced to come to terms with the commitments they took on defeating the Carthaginians in Spain. It also put the Romans in very, very close association with all of these barbarian peoples of the Iberian Peninsula. And as I alluded to, the Romans were going to have to find new ways of cementing relations with these people, and especially working out their own institutions, military and political, eventually administration as well, into dealing with what were now overseas provinces. One point that has to be always kept in mind about the Roman expansion in the 3rd, 2nd, and 1st century BC, it was still very much Mediterranean-based. The Romans had moved into northern Italy, Cisalpine Gaul, that taxed them. But ultimately, Roman armies that went to Spain were sent by sea. They didn't march along the long coastal roads from Italy to Spain as much as possible. Forces were sent by sea. The supplying and equipping of Roman armies in Spain very heavily depended on the Greek and Punic cities, the Iberian towns that had acquired the ports and the institutions of a Mediterranean city. So a city such as Tarraco or Gades or New Carthage, or Carthago Nova, as the Romans would call it, became the major foci of Roman influence in the peninsula. And so as the Romans then got their military forces over to Spain, they were then faced with the major problem of moving them into the interior and mastering all of these different barbarian people, and that took a great deal of effort on their part. Between 206 BC and 197 BC, for the first decade, the Romans tended to treat these possessions very loosely. They sent out governors, and they really shouldn't even be called governors. They sent out magistrates, many of them from the Cornelian gens. That is, they had the same name as Scipio Africanus and his father and uncle had been so instrumental in winning the peninsula's tribes over to Rome's side in the Second Punic War. And the Romans wanted to dodge the responsibility of running this area. They knew the wealth was important. Furthermore, the Romans were committed to the pacification of Cisalpine Gaul. They had wars with Carthage. There were wars in the east. And another aspect about Roman expansion in this period of the late Republic, running from the end of the Second Punic War down to the triumph of the Emperor Augustus at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, when the Roman monarchy really was established, is that Rome fought wars simultaneously. The Romans were not in the habit of, well, we'll deal with this problem, we won't deal with... The Romans were more than capable of fighting three, four wars simultaneously in very far-flung frontiers. Nonetheless, that meant they had to marshal their resources and give their attention to one frontier over another. And as I noted, in the 190s BC, the key frontier to most Romans were the Celts in northern Italy. And by 190 BC, that situation had changed, and northern Italy was quickly assimilated into greater Italy over the course of the 2nd century BC. And that accounts for why the Romans paid much more attention to Spain. They were able to put more magistrates and efforts into the Spanish provinces. In 197 BC, the Roman Senate took an important step by dividing Spain into, in effect, two provinces. And again, the whole thing is so Roman in perspective. I mean, the Romans divided them in a province called Farther and Nearer Spain. Just like Gaul, whether you were farther or closer from Rome determined what name you got. So Hispania Ulterior, the farther Spain, comprised the southern coasts around Gades, New Carthage, that is the old Punic core, and nearer Spain, Hispania Citerior, was the Ebro Valley, that is the river that runs into the Mediterranean. It included Iberian and Greek cities and was closer to Roman Italy and was generally regarded as the more senior post. That is, a consul was more likely to be sent there, and a junior official like a praetor would be sent into farther Spain. In addition to that division, the Romans found themselves, from 197 BC on, saddled with some really tough wars against the Celt-Iberian tribes. They didn't lay down their arms suddenly after the fighting ceased between Romans and Carthaginians. And initially, these were raids on the order of cattle rustling. But after a while, the Celt-Iberian tribes had very well armed and disciplined by Carthaginian and Roman commanders. That is, these people had been armed and given the organization and the incentive to fight in the course of the Second Punic War, were attacking the towns in the coastal zones and the hinterlands of the coast. And that meant the Romans had to do something to protect these areas and also to protect the routes linking these towns to the mineral wealth, the mines. There were extremely important silver mines already known in the area immediately to the west of New Carthage, in the region now known as Mercia. These mines, by 150 BC, were producing fabulous amounts of wealth to the Roman state. Spain likewise had large amounts of other resources which helped feed the development of urban Italy in the course of the 2nd century BC. One commodity that eventually took over was Spanish olive oil, which was being exported to Italy already in the 2nd century BC, and Spanish oils and wines would grace the table of the best families in Rome by the end of the 2nd century BC. So the Romans had reasons to hold this area. In 195 BC, Marcus Porcius Cato, the elder, Cato the censor, arrived as consul of the year with a very large army into the nearer province, that is, Hispania Citerior, the northeastern corner, and that's because that province was closer to Rome, which is another aspect of Roman identity. In Latin, Urbs, city, there's only one city. It's Rome. Urbs and everything else doesn't count as a city. The Romans are equally obnoxious on that attitude as well. But he arrived in nearest Spain and waged campaigns for 2 years. He was extended as proconsul for another year. That is, he held his powers even though the office had lapsed. And he gives us a fairly detailed account of what went on. This is one of the rare instances where a Republican governor or commander actually tells us the types of fighting. And it's very mobile. I mean, Cato doesn't pay attention to any kind of administrative lines. He's moving around. It's clear part of the problem the Romans faced from the start, his army was very large. He brought with him a full consular army, which meant he had two Roman legions, legions of Roman citizens, and two allied Italian legions. And the fighting force in a legion is about 5,000 men or more. That's 20,000 Italians. He recruited local allies. He's in a constant problem of finding money and supplies. He's trying to protect loyal towns. He's raging very tough battles in the middle and upper Ebro, especially against the cities of Segovia and Numantia. These are Iberian towns where there's a certain Celtic population in it as well. They prove very tough opponents. These Celt-Iberians understand siege warfare. And some of the earliest and most impressive Roman fortifications we have in the provinces of siege works comes from the city of Numantia, which was to plague the Romans down to 133 BC. And so what Cato's governorship represents is the opening of a very long and desultory war that runs from 197 down to 179 BC, about a 20-year period in which both provinces called for repeated Roman attention to battle these Celt-Iberian tribes that are in central Spain, attacking towns, interfering with the mining operations from the Roman viewpoint. From the Celt-Iberian viewpoint, this was perfectly logical. Probably these tribes were suffering from overpopulation. They had a very powerful professional warrior elite drilled by the best Carthaginian officers and Roman officers available. They found no other outlet for this. There was no mercenary service. And in central Spain, populations get overcrowded and too many mouths to feed very, very quickly. The only way to export the population is by migration or mercenary service or slave trade. And the result was this constant fighting going along. And from the start, the Romans very quickly found out in Spain, as any colonial power does, is that borders don't mean anything. I mean, the Romans didn't even attempt to draw some kind of line of demarcation. Well, this is going to be Roman territory and this is Celt-Iberian territory. They very, very quickly understood that the only way the system could be brought into some kind of equilibrium is to establish alliances and arrangements with the native populations, and that you could have frontier zones. And you try to regulate the fighting going on in there, and you try to regulate the movement of populations, give encouragement to the building of highways, and you maintain certain military positions. But you really can't impose any kind of border as it would be understood by a modern state today. It just wasn't possible. And the Romans didn't even think in those terms, probably. They didn't even try. So from 197 to 179 BC, the wars were primarily waged to break the power of the individual tribes. And that meant, given the nature of Roman command structure, that at best, Cato's there for 2 years, he comes back, he celebrates a triumph. He did break the power of tribes in and around the area of Emporium, which is in northern Spain, a Greek colony that was threatened. He imposed certain order there, but each year, or at most 2 years, a Roman magistrate would break the power of one particular tribe and restore order. That meant nothing that the whole overall situation had been restored. And very quickly, the Senate understood this. It started proroguing commands to 2 and 3 years. I mentioned earlier, they changed the whole official calendar by 180 BC. The year now started on January 1 in Rome, not on March 15th. That would give an extra 2.5 months for the elected consul to get to Spain to recruit and drill Spanish allies along with the soldiers he's bringing in from Italy. Increasingly, the fighting is taken over by Italian allies. By the 180s BC, two-thirds of the Roman army going into Spain, and this is not local allies recruited on the spot, but the Romans arriving from Italy, are either Italian allies or allies of Latin status. From the reports we get, and we have very good reports on this in Livy until we lose his account in 167 BC, the reports are that probably almost all the cavalry coming from Italy is not Roman, it's Latin. Much of the infantry, most of the infantry are Italian allies from South Central Italy who have increasingly learning Latin, learning Roman tactics and drill that has its own implications back home. And so these are really very much a mixed imperial army with one only has to think of comparisons with the British Empire in the 19th century. Most of the English soldiers fighting overseas were Irish, Scots, Welsh, people coming from the marginal zones at home, and that's what was obviously serving in the Roman armies in Italy, the mountain peoples of Italy who were not yet Roman citizens, but were only allies of Rome. So these armies are battling in Spain, and they're creating a whole new identity in these armies. This first phase of fighting, which we dignify by the term the First Celt-Iberian War, which is hard to really understand it as a war as we know it, was brought to a close by an extraordinary governor, a praetor, that is a junior official, Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, a name that might sound familiar because he is the father of a son with the same name, Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, who is remembered today as the great reformer in Roman tradition. He sponsors an important land bill in 133 BC as tribune, gets killed for it. And that political agitation in Rome is seen as a turning point in what is often called the Roman Revolution. Well, his father had served in Spain. He was from a very high plebeian noble family, married, by the way, into the Scipionic family, that is the Cornelii, the family that originally had gotten Spain. And that helped. I mean, that was recognized. The Spanish, the Celt-Iberian chieftains particularly understood that. Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus campaigned for 2 hard years, broke several tribes, got Numantia, that critical city in the Ebro Valley, to agree to terms, extended some sort of control over the high plateau, and he signed a group of settlements in which he authorized the settling of tribal units within the provinces, and he gave land. A number of tribes that either had agreed to lay down their arms or in some cases surrendered were resettled by the Romans. We're told of one town in particular, Gracchus, named after Gracchus. It's founded in the middle Ebro Valley. Was established as a Spanish community, but it had the kind of municipal institutions and organizations you would associate with a Roman city. And Tiberius Gracchus was finally remembered by the various Spanish peoples. He had given them land. He had founded towns. And Gracchus understood that the only way to stabilize this situation was to use some of what was learned in northern Italy, that is, promote towns, trade, cement alliances with the different tribal leaders, settle the overpopulated populations in vacant lands that were technically under Roman authority but were either underused or could be put under cultivation, that is, extend the arable, and hopefully relieve some of that population pressure that had built up on the plateau. It proved a success. For the next 20 years, the Spanish provinces are quiet. And this is not a function of the fact that we lose Livy's main account. It seems that it solved the problem, at least temporarily. It set in place a set of economic and social relations which tied a number of these tribes to the towns and ultimately linked them to the Mediterranean community, much along the lines of what I described in northern Italy. Except Spain was just a far greater and more daunting task than northern Italy could ever be. Furthermore, there were Celt-Iberian tribes in the west, particularly the Lusitanians in Portugal and southwestern Spain, who were not really brought into this alliance structure. There were enormous mining opportunities. That is, Romans moved in to exploit the mines. Many Roman veterans who had served in Spain start settling in these communities. And that caused tensions, especially in some of the mining districts. And there grew up along this very ill-defined border a very rough and ready frontier society characterized by a lot of hard living, a lot of brigandage. And one only has to think of the type of towns that pop up in any kind of gold rush or silver rush. These are not places of high Roman society. These are tough miners and people coming in to exploit the miners, especially the mines in Mercia. And a typical mine might have, you know, a couple of thousand miners working, but there are thousands of people, especially the gambling establishments and all the entertainment industry that goes with it, all the usual problems you would expect as you bring these people into traditional community. So there were a number of points of conflict between these Roman provinces and the Celt-Iberian tribes. Furthermore, the population pressures mounted, and it is about 20 years, that is, in time for another generation of warriors to grow up among the Celt-Iberians, where the Romans start experiencing difficulty again and find that they're going to have to increase the garrisons and do something about it. Now, this leads to the eruption of several wars. They are fought almost simultaneously. There's a war fought against the Lusitanians in the southwest, and that rages from 154 to 138 BC. There's a second Celt-Iberian war in the 150s. There's another one that breaks out in the 140s and the 130s. What these wars really are is just a series of actions against different tribes who never really stopped fighting. I mean, there was extended time out and armistices along the way, but the Romans found themselves constantly fighting one group. They would shift forces over there. That would lead another group. And what the Romans found in this particular set of wars that went on from 154 to 133 BC, they found that this was far different from the previous group they fought. For one, the Romans now faced Spanish opponents who were very, very adept in exploiting Roman weaknesses. There were clearly methodical operations. We would call them guerrilla operations. These were not raids along the old tradition of attacking a town, driving off livestock, enticing the Romans into a battle to show your individual valor. The Lusitanian Wars were waged by two different leaders. We know their names as Punicus and Caesarus, which are odd. They're Latinized names, and that suggests that the leadership, especially for the Lusitanians in the southwest, are coming from natives who are already partially acculturated to Roman and Iberian institutions and are able to impose a discipline in which their wars are really guerrilla operations, destroying bases for the Romans. The Romans have to move in there. The second point is that these tribes become much better at organizing in larger groups, and they carry out some really embarrassing ambushes. There are serious defeats. Not just long service and the usual losses you get from disease and accidents. And you have to remember, in any ancient army, you know, two-thirds of your casualties were through disease and accidents. A lot of vehicle accidents, desertions are common. And one always has to think of the comment of Frederick the Great of Prussia, where he said, never have your army camp in a forest because you never know who's going to show up for roll call that next morning, because everyone, you know, all the guys desert into the forest at night and you can't find them the next day. And, you know, the Roman army endured all of these problems, but they were embarrassing defeats. Lucius Mummius, who was praetor of the farther province in 153 BC, was lured into an ambush in which 9,000 men fell. Now, if those statistics are at all accurate, that's most of his army. He was a praetor, that is a junior official. He had two legions. He went on later to become the conqueror of Corinth and organize the Roman province of Greece, and he nearly got killed in an early action in Spain. And if you follow the careers of the Roman great aristocrats of the second half of the second century BC, every major figure who is of any political or military importance in the Roman Republic had major service in Spain at this time, and it molded and shaped their attitudes very powerfully. Twice in the course of the fighting against the Lusitanians, his name was Quintus Fabius Maximus Aemilianus, and Publius Cornelius Scipio Aemilianus. These were two brothers of the Aemilian gens who had been adopted into other families, the Fabii and the Cornelii. The second one is the second Scipio Africanus. He's by adoption the grandson of the first one. Both of them went into Spain with armies recruited from volunteers. We are told that they deliberately did not look at the property qualification. They took volunteers, and it is suggestive of the increasing hardship in Italy in fighting these wars. And that meant if you brought in volunteers from the landless, men who didn't have the property for the arms and the training, you're going to have to recruit and drill them. We also find the Romans engaged in some really sleazy tactics to break Spanish resistance. One of the most sleazy was in 150 BC. Servius Sulpicius Galba convinced a tribe of Lusitanians to surrender on the promise of land. He was going to give them a settlement like Gracchus did back in 179. And as soon as he got these Spaniards disarmed, he immediately massacred them. And this is repeated in several other instances. He violated all of his oaths, and it really this was seen as pretty bad. He got tried at Rome for this. He got off. I mean, probably bribed the jury. But nonetheless, the Romans at least put him on trial, which suggests that even the Roman Senate, the aristocratic Senate, which is hesitant to ever put one of its members on trial, even they reckon, now this is really getting pretty bad. Sulpicius went on to a successful, but if not distinguished, career. Ironically, that there was another massacre that was staged by a successor in 147 BC, and in that massacre, a guy by the name of Variathus escaped. And Variathus turned out to be one of the most successful guerrilla leaders fighting the Romans down to 130. They eventually had to buy his assassination in order to break that revolt. So in some ways, the Romans found themselves faced with an opponent where you just couldn't use the types of methods in Cisalpine Gaul. You couldn't get them into the kind of pitched battles against a civilized opponent, and you fought these horribly difficult wars with all sorts of supply problems where your army could starve to death. If it broke up, it would be defeated in detail. And this characterized the wars of this really bloody generation running from 154 to 133 BC. The fighting of what is known as the Third Celt-Iberian War, and as I said, this really just extension of the operation, in the 140s and 130s BC in the Middle Ebro Valley really characterized the problems the Romans faced. Numantia was a important Celt-Iberian stronghold in the northeast. It was one of the major threats against the nearer province. And general after general was sent against this city. And as I said, from 153 to 133 BC, the city was put under Roman siege several times. We have awesome siege works from there, some of the best around. And the Romans still couldn't reduce this town. The Numantines and their various allies in the interior just proved extremely tough. And in trying to break Numantia, you can see some of the problems. In 141 BC, the consul Quintus Pompeius, related to the later Pompey the Great, he's a collateral line, a new man was elected, led his army in there, fought a battle against the Numantines, actually was tactically defeated, but concluded a treaty with the Numantines so he could claim a triumph back in Rome, which the Senate immediately tore up and said, no treaties, go defeat them. They sent other generals in who got no success. The worst of it was in 137 BC, Gaius Hostilius Mancinus, who was sent in as a consul. This is like the fourth army sent against Numantia. And Mancinus blundered. His armies typically had the supply problems. He He encamps in a position that gets surrounded by the Numantines. The next morning he wakes up, and these Celtiberians are ready to slaughter him. And after the way the Romans have dealt with them for the last 15 years, you would think the Roman army would be annihilated. And instead they hear that Tiberius Gracchus, the son of that governor back in 179, is in the ranks. They invite him, and the young Gracchus, he's only a quaestor, he's a financial official, arranges a truce. And the Roman army escapes. Now, the Spanish know enough about Roman military procedure to send them under the yoke. That is, they set up two spears with a bar over it. And as you walk through, you have to bend down as a way of subservience. So they're not going to humiliate the Romans. And they come back with a treaty. There's popular outrage. Mancinus is put on trial. Gracchus is put on trial. Pompeius. It's a complete fiasco. Mancinus is actually tried and convicted for military incompetence and is sent back to the Numantines. And there's nothing more bizarre than sending the consul stripped nude in chains to the Spaniards, who look at this nude consul, don't know what to do with him, and send him back to the Romans. Fighting continues. Mancinus disappears from the record. And finally, the way the city is broken is they bring in Scipio Aemilianus, the adoptive grandson. He raises a volunteer army. He's elected to consul in violation of the rules. He goes in there and eventually captures and breaks the city in 133. Well, that action, and that I've focused on the Ebro Valley, that action, that fighting in that area, as well as simultaneous fighting in the west, eventually wears down the Spanish opponents and breaks the power of the Celtiberian tribes. But they're still fighting. That goes on. There's large sections of Spain that remain outside of Roman control for the next century. And it isn't until 25 and 19 BC when the far northwest is finally brought under control. And that requires an imperial army of 7 legions. It requires the Emperor Augustus's best general, Agrippa. The fighting in Spain has been costly. It has been brutal. And we will see some of the costs of that later on in this course and how difficult this fighting was for the majority of Romans and Italians who had to undertake that service. And I think the worst piece of information you could receive as a Roman citizen in the 2nd century BC is that, congratulations, you're about to be drafted for an expedition to Spain. I mean, it was just, you were not coming back. And if you did, your family was going to be ruined if you were fortunate. On the other hand, in the course of fighting these wars against the Celtiberian tribes of the interior, the Romans learned some very important and difficult lessons. One was that there aren't clear frontier lines. And when older generations of scholars in the 19th and 20th century studied Roman history and relations with barbarian peoples, there's always an obsession to draw lines on maps. And of course, they do have their value. But the Romans very quickly in Spain learned there isn't a clear definable border and that in dealing with barbarian peoples, you're imposing a political control to achieve certain military and political objectives, and often these boundaries run right through important cultural and economic zones. For one, rivers never function as very good boundaries. Rivers are really lines of communication. This will become a major theme of the Romans on the Rhine and the Danube in Central Europe. And so you don't set up any kind of Maginot line. The second important point is it's absolutely imperative to win over those elites, those local elites. The kind of perfidious treatment that some of these leaders and tribes received in the 150s and 140s BC, which sparked a series of political trials, that's indicative that this wasn't going to work in the long run. It might get a governor a victory and so a triumph. But the Senate and the assemblies back in Rome had to think in longer terms. And this was a problem given that nature of rotating commands. Governors went out there with maybe 1 or 2 years. And Spain became a particularly sleazy case of triumph hunting in the 150s and 140s. That is, governors going out, trying to lure a tribe into a battle and defeating them. There are two instances where a treaty was actually concluded with a major Celtiberian tribe, and the next governor showed up. Actually, one of them was the brother of the previous governor, tears up the treaty because he wants his war, and he wants the honor of concluding the war. And this is one of the problems built into that Roman constitution, that better methods of dealing with these peoples would have to be evolved. This would be solved in the imperial age, where you begin to get governors, as we understand them, who went out for 3 and 4 terms, in some cases 6 years, who could then evolve some sort of relationship with the local peoples, and that in turn would allow them to administer these provinces. But in Spain, they found very, very quickly that the whole system could break down very quickly when a new governor came in. Third, it became important that the only way to succeed in Spain is you had to win over Spanish allies. You needed them for their manpower. You had to put in settlements that would encourage the development of cities at strong points. Highways became all important. That is, the methods that had worked in uniting Italy overland through highways, and this was going to have to be applied to Spain on a very wide level. And this is what's going to characterize Spain in the late 2nd century B.C. and 1st century B.C., putting in a lot of what we would call that infrastructure to build a provincial society.